Country Why on ABC Radio.
Support businesses are going to go to the wall just like dairy farmers will.
We've seen the whole agricultural community come out.
Once people leave communities, they generally don't return.
Country Why.
Don't worry about me. Go and speak to your farmers.
We're already losing businesses.
Get out there and speak to your farmers today. That's
Country Why, the politics of food and farming on ABC Radio.
Hi, welcome to Countrywide. I'm Megan Hughes. Today, Australia negotiates a free trade agreement with the UK. But what do Brits think?
The more that British voters feel standards are high, the more they want to trade with that country. And Australia is actually in that elite club.
And speaking of sending Aussie produce overseas, our country's exports are down due to the pandemic. But there are some positive signs.
It wasn't all doom and gloom either. A couple of our major markets actually finished up slightly for the year. So, you know, we were up a couple of percent in Singapore, a couple of percent in Hong Kong, and a few other Asian markets.
And farmers continue their spending spree on new tractors.
We have been quite surprised by the strength of the market over the past few months. We thought we'd hit a record level sort of earlier in the year. May has certainly topped that again.
All that and more coming up.
From the paddock to the plate, Countrywide on ABC Radio.
But first, the world's largest meat processor, JBS, has confirmed it paid a criminal gang a ransom worth $14.2 million Australian dollars to regain access to its computer operations. The ransom, which was paid in Bitcoin, was made after a cyber attack was launched on the company's computer systems last week. It shut down abattoirs across the globe, including here in Australia, for more than 5 days. There were temporary staff layoffs at some of the plants, and farmers reported their shipments of livestock were cancelled. Matt Dalgleish from Thomas Elder Markets told Nikolai Balhaas, it's actually not uncommon for large companies to pay these ransoms.
The narrative, Nikolai, often is don't pay ransoms. You know, a lot of people say we don't pay ransoms, but then to come out and admit that it's been paid is even more surprising. The fact, A, they paid it, then B, they've admitted to it. But I guess it's becoming commonplace, though, where they probably had limited choice.
It just seems like such a large amount of money as well. I guess in the scheme of the scale of JBS, maybe it's not that much, but it seems like a lot of money.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they're a big entity and certainly... you know, they've probably got the capacity to pay a figure like that. But, you know, like I said, it's with the rise of things like cryptocurrency, it's making it easier for this type of ransom to be successful. In the past, it was much harder to get the money paid, you know, whether it was in cash or into an account, whereas nowadays with the lack of, I guess, traceability, it's really, we're seeing a big growth in this kind of style of ransomware attack.
And is there some concern that it helps kind of set that precedent of, you know, that often quoted line of, you know, well, we don't negotiate with terrorists or with people that are holding us to ransom, but now it seems a lot of people do.
Yeah, I think it does. And that's the other aspect I was saying before, the fact that it's been, you know, fairly widely published and, you know, that they've paid the ransom. I think it does set a bit of a dangerous precedent.
Is food processing particularly vulnerable in this space because of the timeliness and because of supply chains that really do rely on continuity and continuity of supply?
Yeah, look, I guess any business, and we're talking about a lot, not just in the food supply space, but, you know, that just-in-time style of inventory, you know, and food in particular, you know, meat product that's perishable, you've only got limited amount of time that you can have any downtime, really. So it impacts your business significantly. But there's a lot of businesses that would be using that style of inventory where if they are offline for a day or two, it becomes incredibly problematic for the cash flow of the business.
Should this be of concern to smaller Australian producers? Maybe not the, you know, the JBSs of the world, but smaller businesses or even sole traders that probably don't have a dedicated IT team? Should they be worried?
Look, I think... part of it would be capacity to pay as well. So, you know, to be a target, I mean, any business should have, you know, significantly, you know, kind of good systems for their IT and for cybersecurity. You'd be foolish not to have, you know, systems in place. But I think it's probably those businesses that are on the hit list of these types of criminals, these international networks, would be, you know, those larger types, I think, that would have the capacity to pay and could be severely disrupted So like your JBSs of the world, the smaller operators, maybe they just wouldn't, you know, appear on the criminal's radar potentially. But I think it is a wake-up call for any business to make sure that they're as safe as they can be in terms of their cyber security and their access to their networks.
That's Matt Dalgleish, Manager of Commodity Market Insights at Thomas Elder Markets. We contacted JBS Australia for an interview, but they declined. In a statement on JBS United States website, the company said it was a difficult decision, but they felt it had to be made to prevent any risk for their customers. Australia and the United Kingdom are currently negotiating a free trade agreement. UK farmers have raised concerns about Australian animal welfare standards and have been lobbying Westminster to demand all Australian meat imports meet the high standards imposed on local products. But a new survey has shown widespread public support for the deal in the UK, despite these concerns. It was commissioned by free market think tank, the Adam Smith Institute. Head of research Dr. Michael Turner told Cassie Huff two-thirds of Brits would support a free trade deal with Australia, even if it meant increased competition for British farmers and some going out of business.
Clearly the biggest takeaway is just the sheer level of support for, you know, free trade and for getting this deal done, both in the UK and in Australia. So more than two-thirds of Brits and Aussies support this deal, and the UK is number one on the list as a priority to do more trade with for Australians, and Australia is number one on the list for as a priority to do more trade with for Brits.
Drilling down into some of those numbers, though, we have heard in recent weeks that there has been a bit of nervousness from the UK livestock producers, in particular sheep and cattle producers, about Australian meat, beef and lamb being imported into the country. When you look at perhaps more commodity-specific numbers, what sort of support is there in the UK for Australian produce going into the country?
So very strong levels of support for Australian wine, Australian lamb, beef. The majority of Brits say that they would like to be able to buy and purchase that more often and see it more often in British supermarkets. And actually, you know, to that point that you raised earlier on about you know, whether or not there's support for seeing more Australian lamb or not in the UK market, there's very clear support for that. And actually, in fact, most Brits want Australian beef to be the default alternative to British beef on British supermarkets.
How do the Britons you surveyed feel about Australia's animal welfare and food safety, given this is an issue that has been raised by the Farmers Federation in the UK?
At the heart of these findings is an interesting trend, which is that the more that British voters feel standards are high, the more they want to trade with that country. And Australia is actually in that elite club in the eyes of Brits that has very high standards. A very large proportion of Brits feel that Australia has high levels of animal welfare and standards of produce as well. And because of that, there is a really strong relationship which says that we would like to trade with Australia more.
There's been less backlash in Australia. If you look at the trade coming the other way, what sort of support has there been in Australia for Australia to be trading more with the UK?
It's remarkable, actually, how similar these results are. I think one of the key points of the research is that there is very similar levels of support among Australians for the deal as there are among Brits. Certainly things like British cheese, shortbread, jam and marmalade, even the Cornish pasty, the famous Cornish pasty, made down in Cornwall in England. There's high levels of support. A majority of voters would like to see more jam and marmalade from the UK and cheese, and many would like to see Scottish whisky as well. So I think there is obviously a great deal of support, you know, among Brits. But what was surprising is that equally as many Australians support British produce coming over as well. And they say they would like to see more choice. And, you know, we also asked them about cars and whether they'd like to see more British manufacturers as part of the mix in Australia, and, you know, more than two-thirds of Australians said that they would actually like to see more British options, and they would consider them also when they are thinking about making their next car purchase.
This free trade agreement obviously extends beyond food and beverage trade. When you look at other issues at play when countries are negotiating a free trade agreement, what are some of the other findings you've uncovered through this survey?
This thing goes in the eyes of Brits, way beyond just produce, also it's also focused on workers. And it's very clear that Brits, you know, see Australian workers as high standards, very professional. We asked this question about whether or not they would trust, you know, being treated by an Australian nurse. And overwhelming majority, 91%, 92% of Brits say that they would trust being treated by an Australian nurse, and they don't think that they should have to requalify to be able to work in the UK. And that's sort of symptomatic about sort of the way that Brits see Australians. They feel that they are hard workers, but they also kind of trust them and their standards as professionalism.
Do you think that the agricultural trade issues will be enough to hold up the UK-Australia FTA?
No, I don't. And there's two reasons why. Firstly, is that the overwhelming support to be able to kind of build further economic relations with Australia is clear from these results. But secondly, is a unique thing in these data that show Brits back British farmers to see this as an opportunity to grow their businesses and to innovate and to compete globally, as do Australians for Australian farmers.
That was Adam Smith Institute Fellow Dr. Michael Turner talking to Cassie Huff. You'll soon hear from Federal Agriculture Minister David Littleproud on how the free trade agreement is progressing.
From the top end to Tassie, Countrywide on ABC Radio.
Every year, Australian growers produce enough food for 75 million people. That's three times the population of our country. During lockdown and panic buying, shelves were filled with fresh produce here, but it wasn't as straightforward for exports. Flights have been grounded, there's been disruptions in shipping lines, and issues getting containers anyway, so Australian exports took a hit. But Export Development Manager for Lobby Group AusVeg, Michael Coote, explains to Amy Phillips why it's so important to keep Aussie produce in those international markets.
Look, in 2020, during COVID, and coming out of a pretty difficult start to the year with drought, bushfires, road freight disruptions, etc., the vegetable industry still managed to export around 216,000 tonnes, valued at over $263 million, to over 50 countries globally. So we dropped about 6.6% in value terms from the previous year. But given the breadth of disruptions and the challenges faced by growers, farmers and exporters, a dip of 6% was actually, you know, a fairly reasonable outcome. Within that, though, some crops actually fared pretty well. So our carrot exports were up, as were potatoes and onions. But some of the more heavily air freight reliant perishable crops like leafy salads, brassicas, broccoli, cauliflower, etc., did see a bit of a dip. And looking at some of our export markets for fresh vegetables, it wasn't all doom and gloom either. A couple of our major markets actually finished up slightly for the year. So, you know, we were up a couple of percent in Singapore, a couple of percent in Hong Kong, and a few other Asian markets.
Yeah, incredible. As you say, logistics continues to be the number one issue. Carrots, they're the biggest export in Australia. Queensland certainly contributing to that. Why did they go up?
So carrots are the biggest fresh vegetable export, certainly, about $100 million and 100,000 tonnes nationally each year, with quite a portion of that coming out of Western Australia and then Queensland and Tasmania. So the retail demand in international markets actually was fairly buoyant and very strong in certain markets. As you can probably imagine, when we saw food service and hospitality shut down in parts of Australia during our COVID outbreak. And certainly in Victoria, that I lived through last year as well. The same thing was happening in foreign countries. In Hong Kong, they had a lockdown. Singapore had a lockdown, etc. So people were buying more and cooking at home.
Meat, potatoes, and veggies. It seemed to be what the entire world lived on during cooking at home. Let's now talk about some of the issues to the long road of recovery, as you say, is ahead of the fruit and veggie export industry. What would you identify as the biggest impacts to exports?
Disruptions in shipping lines, issues with getting containers, voyage times blowing out, and costs going up. We're seeing, you know, federal government funding for keeping aeroplanes coming in and out of the country, which is due to funding's due to run out at the end of September with an operational rundown till late October, I believe. But, you know, unless there's some sort of contribution from the federal government to keep that program going in some form, then, perishable fresh fruit and vegetable growers and exporters won't be able to service export markets if there are no planes and no freight capacity. So that will be a serious challenge to our ability to keep supplying international customers, a lot of whom who are, you know, hard-fought, long-term customers and relationships that growers and exporters have built. And, you know, if we exit an export market, we have no guarantee that we'll be able to, recapture that and recapture market share, you know, if and when the world starts to return to some sort of normality and trade can commence.
That's Export Development Manager for AusVeg, Michael Coote. Another issue exporters are facing is a rise in fees and charges. They fear the rise in July will make them less competitive and less profitable. But Federal Agriculture Minister David Littleproud told Amy Phillips it's necessary to recover the costs of regulating the sector.
Well, the Australian taxpayer is paying the regulatory costs to protect Brand Australia. So the Australian taxpayer can't continue to do that. But the increase as a percentage of a consignment is for particularly like citrus is around 0.36% of a consignment. So it's not a significant amount, but in terms of total consignment costs, we understand that there is an increase, and we are trying to work also through, while we are imposing this, working back to a full cost recovery to the Australian taxpayer, is impose and implement technology that will streamline and actually, in the long run, reduce the regulatory burden for producers and exporters across the country.
Is the 50% rate correct? I know in the live export industry, you've reviewed those fees and charges.
Yeah, you've got to put it in the context of what the total cost is of the consignment. That's a dangerous statistic to be throwing around, an easy one, but the reality is the Australian taxpayer just can't continue to do this for people. This is a service that is provided so that they can export their goods and make sure that they are to the standard that Australians would expect, and that's a cost of doing business. We're trying to reduce it, and I've challenged the department that they need to continue to look at their cost structure, how they do it, and to do it better.
The IFAM, there's a lot of concern here at the Fruit and Veggie Conference that the IFAM's going to finish in October, which is expected, and leave them high and dry and exposed to losing markets they've and you have for years worked hard to get. Will IFAM be extended beyond October?
Well, look, the government's shown that we've been agile with COVID, and we started off with around $300 million and it's now $670 million. So we've shown the agility that we've needed to protect markets, understanding that we've got to be a good export partner, not only in the good times but also the bad times. And that's why we introduced this mechanism. And obviously we will look at this further depending on how COVID evolves, not only here in Australia but also globally.
Minister, will this weekend the UK FTA be signed, and are our Aussie growers going to be the winners or losers?
Too early to say. I hate to speculate. I know Minister Tehan and I have been in contact, and we're close to getting some close agreements on a number of factors, but there are still sticking points, and Australia doesn't need to sign up to something that doesn't benefit Australian agriculture, and we've got 14 other free trade agreements that we put in place and work very well for Australia, but we'd like to have another one. We welcome the UK's interest in coming back to Australia since they exited us in the 70s, but we did find this thing called Asia, and they've been very good. Our Asian family has been very good to us, but we'd be happy to sign an agreement if it meets our expectations.
That's Federal Agriculture Minister David Littleproud speaking to Amy Phillips.
Countrywide, the voice of regional Australia on ABC Radio.
You're listening to Countrywide. I'm Megan Hughes. Shortly, you'll find out what's driving Aussie farmers to spend up big on new tractors. But before that, you may have seen the confronting videos and photos online of the mouse plague across the country. It's been an ongoing issue for 10 months in New South Wales, southern Queensland, northern Victoria and South Australia. Well, now there's a glimmer of hope. The CSIRO says it's seen promising signs that mice have stopped breeding in the central west of New South Wales. They can breed from 6 weeks old and produce a litter in as little as 19 days. So it's important to break the breeding cycle. Trials are being conducted on double-strength baits, which are due for release soon. But CSIRO Research Officer Steve Henry told Lucy Thackray that the signs, in parks at least, are good.
We've had a team of people trapping out there for the last week or so. It's part of an experiment to test the new double-strength zinc phosphide bait, and we've been trapping across 9 separate locations there. While trap success is still really, really high, we didn't catch any reproductive females over that week of trapping. So we were still getting 130% adjusted trap success, which takes into account, because 130 is theoretically impossible, but that takes into account traps that become available as they've caught other animals. Although in one case we caught 9 animals in one trap, which is a huge number for a single capture trap. But yeah, while we're catching a quite a large range of age classes, none of the animals were pregnant.
Would you expect that at this time of year, or would you have expected that to have happened earlier?
Yeah, look, we would be hopeful that they would have stopped breeding by now, although reports from northern New South Wales, when I was up there the week before last, when farmers were pulling up grain bags, and there's been a lot of that going on because they're endeavouring to protect their stored grain now in any way they possibly can. And so some farmers were reporting nests of babies underneath these grain bags. That was a little bit of a surprise to us, but it has been an incredibly warm, mild autumn, and so lots of food, lots of shelter, no reason for them to stop breeding.
What have you observed about the efficacy of the new double strength zinc phosphide, and is that now readily available for farmers to use?
So we understand that bait producers are manufacturing it now. In terms of the efficacy, I put out the first lots of double strength baits into our experimental sites just on Saturday. So we'll be trapping next week, and hopefully we'll have some information about just how effective it is over the coming weeks.
How hopeful are you about that new double strength zinc phosphide?
The results out of the lab when we did the tests, so we did the original sensitivity tests, putting known doses of zinc phosphide directly into the stomachs of mice. That was the work that identified the need for the increase. And then when we tested individual mice in cages, the results of that were really promising, and we're just hoping that they transfer out into the field. Now, certainly we're not going to kill less mice using the double strength, but the proportional difference between the 25 gram and the 50 gram, we're just uncertain of at the moment in the field, but we're hoping that will be significant.
What are you hearing from farmers that put winter crops in recently?
Varied reports about the level of damage, and we were actually, while we're out walking around on the ground, you could actually see some areas where, small portions of crops have been decimated by mice. But then, further west out around Warren and Trangie, we heard about one canola crop in particular. I think it was 1,200 acres, and it had just been completely decimated by mice. When it got about 10 days out of the ground, they just browsed it off. Depending on how many mice are present, there are varying reports of the amount of damage that we're hearing.
That's CSIRO's Steve Henry talking to Lucy Thackray. Farmers are spending big on tractors thanks to a record harvest and generous tax incentives. In the last year, more than 15,700 tractors have been sold across the country, which is up 37% on the previous 12 months. New South Wales is leading the way. Their sales are up 78%. Cara Jeffrey spoke to Tractor and Machinery Association of Australia Executive Director Gary Northover about the buoyant farm machinery market.
Well, they're still booming, Cara, to be honest. We have been quite surprised by the strength of the market over the past few months. We thought we'd hit a record level sort of earlier in the year. May has certainly topped that again.
And so looking at the latest report that you've put out for May, looks as though New South Wales is still leading the charge year to date with sales up 78% for tractors and 30% on the same month last year. So I guess why are sales so good in New South Wales?
I think there was certainly a period there back in 2019 in particular where that market was very depressed. So a lot of destocking occurred in agricultural businesses. So there has been a fair bit of catch-up in play there. No doubt the market's been healthy. The environment and the weather conditions have been very strong through 2020, which has led to this current demand. But if you go back a year or two before that, there was certainly a bit of catch-up being in play there.
And when you drilled down on the figures, when you did look at how sales were going, were there any states that also surprised you on how well they were doing?
Look, to be honest with you, they've all been very surprising on the upside. Certainly been aware of the impact of the government's instant asset write-off scheme, and that's due to come to an end in June. So we figured, well, you know, there's a lot of demand being absorbed by that. But that's now being continued for another 2 years. So there shouldn't be any panic on the front of buyers to go and take advantage of that, because it's certainly a scheme that's going to continue on. Supply issues have been a challenge. Dealers have been reporting that they've been running low on stocks and haven't always been able to meet the demand of their customers. So the fact that all states really are still humming along at these levels has been very surprising.
And are there any particular ranges of tractors that are really in demand at the moment?
Look, the little ones are always have always been strong through this period. So anything up to 100 horsepower has been very healthy. The larger ones above 100 and even above 200 horsepower tend to be, you know, less, not I want to use the word impulse buy, but they're bought on more of a planned approach, whereas perhaps buyers have been seeing an opportunity to acquire smaller tractors, get the tax write-off and keep going. So that's certainly been a strong part of the market.
And are you hearing from dealers and then buyers a bit further along the chain that there are supply issues getting the gear into Australia, and it's taking a long time from the order date to actually arrive on the farm?
Yeah, look, that's been an issue for some time now. So the sales that we're seeing now have been driven by, you know, stock that was ordered perhaps November, December, January earlier this year. But anything that's been ordered since that time certainly is on a much longer lead time. So dealers are just proving to be a bit reluctant to quote specific delivery times at the moment, because there's just so much uncertainty out there. So it hasn't really played out in today's figures, but there's certainly plenty of indications that that it will in the not too distant future.
But it's not stalling the buy up too much, though. People are still buying up, even though they know that they'll have a bit of a wait.
Well, look, you know, we keep wondering about how much longer this can go, because you know, we're not building new farms necessarily in this country, and there's got to be a point of saturation where the market can only sell so many machines. So yes, we're seeing customers perhaps buying, you know, there would have been a list of product that they've said must-haves, and there may also have been a list of like-to-haves or a wish list that people have been spending against. So at some point, we think that's just got to slow down. So it can't be too far away.
Is there any reason that that the dealers are being told why the supply is delayed? Is it because of COVID-related issues, getting, you know, items on ships and getting them into Australia and through the ports? What are they being told?
Well, look, it's a range of issues. We're seeing certainly Australia's market coinciding with an improvement in the worldwide situation. So, you know, this is what we're seeing in Australia, not much different to what's happening in the US and Europe. So demand out of factories has gone up across the board. So it's not just Australia. There have been certainly issues with supply of raw materials, steel and tyres and the like. So there's been many reports of delays and price increases in some of those components. And no doubt the shipping delays are really starting to show themselves. Clearly, there's been a real flood of imports to this country, not just of agricultural equipment, but everything from motor vehicles to building materials and the like. So our ports have become bottlenecks, and that's caused further delays down the supply chain. So it really is a combination of all of those things, to be honest.
Tractor and Machinery Association of Australia Executive Director Gary Northover speaking to Cara Jeffrey. That's it for Countrywide. You can hear all of these stories and more at abc.net.au/rural. You can also listen back to the Countrywide podcast on the ABC Listen app. I'm Megan Hughes. Thanks for your company.